by 2018, the working class in Mexico had been completely destroyed. I mean, any semblance of class power had been smashed. You had had like real harsh neoliberalism in Mexico since 1982. And it just kept getting harsher. And anything that gave the popular classes power or standing or even basic dignity had been cut out from under them. And so by 2018, they were, you know, depoliticized, dispirited, and without much of a sense of cause. To AMLO's undying credit, like, he tried to revivify a social movement based on the popular classes that would take power, and that in power, it's been prudent. Maybe it's been too prudent, right? Maybe it hasn't done enough, right? But your first 6 years shouldn't be the only 6 years you get. And like, nobody wanted to see a return to those periodic financial meltdowns that have afflicted Mexico since 82 and 94. And when some of those have happened in part because of very undisciplined and not very well thought out government spending programs.
Everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hokuli here in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and today we're talking about Mexico's election, previewing what will be an important election this weekend. It's Wednesday, the 29th of May. You're hearing this, well, Thursday, the 30th of May, and I'm here with Roger Lancaster, who's telling me what's about to go down in Mexico City within about half an hour of us recording this.
Within a half hour, the campaign will close. I suppose everyone is going to be having a campaign final event right about now. Sheinbaum's will be a monster rally in the Zócalo of Mexico City.
A million people, you're predicting.
I'm predicting. Like, we'll see if this cap. I'm predicting a million people. That means the Zócalo will be full and overflowing into the side streets.
No, I mean, the Zócalo is this, I haven't been to Mexico City, but it's this massive square right in the center, right? I mean, it's just enormous by the
like
pictures.
Red Square. It's one of those enormous public squares, and it's truly a phenomenon to behold. The center, the capital, the center of the old Aztec Empire was there. And of course,
right. There
it is today still, like in the center of Mexican cultural life, in a way, Mexican political life, certainly.
Well, and the ability to get huge masses of people all together in one place. Well, I guess that's kind of a little bit of what we're talking about. So we're gonna talk about the election. I should say for the listeners who don't know Roger, where have you been? Anyway, you should check out the recent episode, which came out, I think, last month on Roger's most recent book. It's a very excellent book called The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for Example. That's part of the title. It's Mexico, for Example. And we talked about that as well as kind of the wider backdrop of Mexican history, the left, conservatism, etc. And now we're going to be talking about the election specifically. But I would urge listeners to go and check out that episode. Roger has lived on and off in Mexico for decades now. So he's going to bring a lot of his experience and knowledge and all of that to bear on this. And we're very interested in this election because well, as we've said, Mexico is going to the polls this Sunday. And it's an election which will lead to Mexico's first woman president. And that probably isn't the main exciting takeaway. I mean, so it's this, the candidate of the ruling center-left Morena party is Claudia Sheinbaum, who Roger has already made reference to, who's the former mayor of Mexico City. And she's looking to extend the legacy of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO for short. And that's what we're going to focus on here, because AMLO rather divides opinion. He's disliked by the right and by the credentialed class. He's also made enemies among feminists and other in the social movements. But he also splits opinion on the left, it seems. So I just want to characterize this by way of reference to two pieces that appeared in the New Left Review's sidecar blog last year, because I think it characterizes kind of the difference of opinion on that there might be on AMLO. I mean, these, whether from outside or from inside, perhaps. Edward Ackerman argued in Sidecar that AMLO is fighting against neoliberalism and maybe even moving beyond it. And he cites ideas like AMLO having raised wages, increased spending, passed pro-union legislation. Now, in opposition to this, Ramon Centeno argued that these successes are overstated, that AMLO's so-called Republican austerity, and we're going to get onto what that is in just a bit, AMLO's Republican austerity is just a sort of leftish rebranding of standard neoliberal fare. AMLO has relied too much on the military, and the left support for him is just another case of the left once again falling for populism instead of struggling for working class autonomy. So I suspect that sets the terms of the debate up quite well in terms of what a kind of varying left interpretations of AMLO have been. And we're going to get on to that because, well, we're going to be talking about AMLO's legacy and how it may or may not be extended. And we're also going to talk a little bit about the deeper meaning of AMLO's populism, I think, because I'm quite interested in this idea of the relationship between the construction of national identity and class struggle and class loathing as well, and how all these things have sort of intermixed under AMLO's 6 years in power. So, Roger, first of all, maybe a slightly awkward question, but what are the stakes in this election? Are there stakes? It seems like a foregone conclusion, but what are the stakes?
What are the stakes? The stakes seem to me big. The stakes are whether the center-left formation that took power in 2018 goes on for a second term, or whether it gets repudiated. And those are the simplest stakes I can imagine. Sheinbaum herself has said, you know, I don't talk about shattering a glass ceiling. That's not what this campaign is about. I'm campaigning to advance the fortunes of everybody, not just me and not just breaking a glass ceiling. And she does this video ad where she says that, you know, surrounded by adoring working class women and peasant women and so on, right? But, the PR in the press will undoubtedly be Mexico elects its first woman, right, president. But the real question is whether what started under AMLO continues. You know, she talks about building the second floor of the fourth transformation, which is a nice way of putting it, right? So the fourth.
Okay, so maybe just rewind a little bit. Maybe we could, if you could tell us who Claudia Sheinbaum is, what she stands for, and also what the opposition looks like, and what its chances are, because that's all. They're also fronted by a woman, which is why I say that, you know, Mexico will definitely have another woman.
This is a strange election, right? It's almost like the political class decided that there was going to be a female president, right? And so they both came up with candidates. So Claudia Sheinbaum is a former PRD member who broke with the PRD. When López Obrador broke with the PRD, she followed him out into the...
And the PRD is?
PRD is, and it, like, as of June, will be was, because I think it will actually disappear as a party. I think it will fall below, I think it's 2.5%, 3% threshold, and will be disqualified. But the PRD was the Party of Democratic Revolution, which had been formed in the aftermath of 1988, when Cárdenas campaigned for president and the election was flagrantly stolen in plain view in front of TV cameras rolling and all of that, right? But the party emerged out of a coalition of left-wing socialist and some Leninist groups who converged in 1988 and provided a platform for Cárdenas' campaign and defections from the PRI. So in one sense, it's a split from the old PRI. It's the left-wing split from PRI. But right. It's also like the base rank and file activists who are all left-wing militants, mostly class of 1968, right? So the PRD, when AMLO left, he took pretty much everything that was worth taking and left a shell. And the PRD currently caucuses with the conservative coalition that's running against Sheinbaum, which is funny.
Right. So what is this? What is this coalition that has been cobbled together from opposition parties who probably don't have that much in common?
So Sheinbaum comes out of the PRD, then into Morena, and she's a ethnic Jewish woman, grandchild of Holocaust survivors, grew up in, her father was a communist activist, grew up in left-wing circles in Mexico City, grew up in a middle-class left-wing background, studied hard, but she ends up in politics, right? So that's her background. Former just stepped down recently as the governor of Mexico City, successful governorship. But you don't govern and campaign, so she's passed it on to an interim governor. Her coalition is Morena and the PT, the Worker Party, the Labor Party. And the Greens have defected from their old coalition with the PRI and come into coalition with with Morena. Now, this is interesting. Like the Greens always campaigned on a free prescription campaign. And that was their, you would think it would be something else given that they're
right. Yeah. Already,
right? But their big ticket item was free prescriptions. And Morena passed those free prescriptions and then the Greens come over and make a new home, right? So there's that. Okay, the opposition is under Xochitl Galvez. And everyone will call her Xochitl. They do, like if I accidentally call her by her first name, I'm not being rude. It's just how these politicians are referred to in Mexico, right? But Galvez comes from an indigenous background. They spoke an indigenous language in the state of Mexico in her home growing up, apparently. And she, too, has a very good educational background. I mean, they're both extremely educated candidates from that sector of the upper middle class in Mexico that not only received education in Mexico, but went abroad to get some more. And she's been a combination politician, businesswoman, for decades. She served in the Fox administration on indigenous affairs. Her coalition is, now get this, right? It's PAN, the conservative party, PRI, the center-left center-left party of the former dictatorship, and PRD, which had been the PRI's sworn enemy all that while, but now they're all kind of in bed together, and they're all going to go down to a rather smashing defeat together, it would appear.
I mean, so that's testament to the way that Morena has reorganized the political spectrum right? In so far as it's managed to, or it's driven the opposition to kind of cobble together some coalition, which might not even make sense, and lose despite
the establishment that. Parties have been hammered hard, and some would say shattered, and they're trying to piece together a jigsaw puzzle coalition that makes no sense. But look, the PRD was already extremely opportunistic going back a couple of decades. The PRD would often form a coalition with PAN in local elections in order to defeat the PRI, their sworn enemy, right? But of course, so the fact that they're all in a coalition together, you know, is very revelatory and interesting. And they're all going to go down to me. I think they'll get about a third of the vote combined, which is not very good for former ruling.
Right. And Sheinbaum is polling at something like 60%. I mean, I don't know if that will materialize, but still, regardless, an overwhelming victory, right?
The polls are varied. Some have her at 54%, which is about the same that AMLO got. It was a landslide overall, but he got 54.5%, right? Some have her at 64%. Now, I think they're both, I think it'll be more like 57%, 58%, something like that. We'll see if it moves, if the dial moves up closer to 64%, as some of the good faith nonpartisan polls show, you'll have a second coming headline would be about the only way of reporting on that, because that would mean, you know, I don't know, that would be very historical.
And how much
party, there is a third party running, the Movimiento Ciudadano. And the guy running on that is Jorge Maynes. And he is probably picking up. Here's a side question, right? So if Xochitl collapses, as she may very well do over the next few days, as people really think about what they've seen and what they've heard and how she's performed, if her vote starts to tank, will the MC pick up and nudge her out of second place? And that would be
an wow.
earth-shattering development.
Right.
I don't think that will happen. I just think PAN is too stubborn. PRI is there too. Like between the PAN and the PRI, she probably will hold at least 30% of the vote and avoid that third place showing. But
I mean, the Movimiento Ciudadano sounds like so many of its type of formation in different countries around the world, which I think to steal like the line from Perry Anderson, yuppie simulacra of populist breakthroughs, which is to say, you know, there's the standard in class terms, just the standard kind of ruling center right party types, except that it's a younger generation who tries to, you know, maybe doesn't wear a tie and pretends it's a little bit different, and usually has names like citizens something, like in Spain you had Ciudadanos as well. So they seem very much of a type.
It's middle class, it's educated, it feigns being sort of left wing, sort of, and it, but in practice it doesn't seem.
Macron is like the biggest representative of this type. I mean, the most successful representative of this type, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So that segment would very much love to have power handed to them in the way that it has been in some other countries, but it just doesn't. It's not in the cards in Mexico, in part because
right.
AMLO has outplayed the opposition in so many ways that it just cuts off their options for that, I think.
All right, just a quick interruption to my interview with Roger Lancaster about Mexico's elections. The entirety of this episode is only available to our patrons at patreon.com/bungacast. You get a good chunk of it free, but if you want to hear more and you want to hear the continuation of our discussion, you'll have to head over to patreon.com/bungacast. You might know this already, but we release new episodes every Tuesday with additional episodes on Thursdays or Fridays most weeks. So Two episodes a month are entirely free, and the rest is only available in full at patreon.com/bungacast. There you'll find episodes with our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Catherine Liu, Amber Lee Frost, and Lee Phillips, and episodes with writers and editors from Damage Magazine, with whom we're partnered. Subscribers to our Patreon also get a free subscription to Damage Magazine. And of course, there's plenty from us, the Bunga Boys, that's Phil, George, and myself, Alex. Now, if you are still subscribed to one of the old tiers, the $5, $10 tier, we would love it if you would upgrade. Only $2 more a month gets you more than double what you were previously offered. So we would love it if you joined us. Those old tiers will be gradually phased out. Now, just to let you know, this is what you might have missed last month if you haven't been subscribed to patreon.com/bungacast, or maybe you have and you've missed some of the things that we've put out. You have our, what I think was an excellent discussion on Isaac Deutscher's monumental biography of Joseph Stalin. That was in the Reading Club. We have a discussion on the politics or anti-politics of Alex Garland's Civil War. And at the start of this week, we had on the renowned music critic Simon Reynolds, he of Retromania fame, talking about his new book, Futuromania, and whether today's high-tech future music is actually all that futuristic in content. And what we've got coming up in June, right? So we have, in just a matter of days, writer Juan Rojas with more on Mexico's election, looking at Morena's rule in a regional context. Is AMLO the future? Also, we have Achin Van Eyck on India, Hindu nationalism, and a re-elected Modi, who still rules, but for how long? And also, Catherine Liu on professional populists in the culture war, Sam Chris on Saudi modernism, and something on gender strife and birth rates in Korea, and much more. That's all just in June. So subscribe, please. Share the episodes if you would, and tell your friends. Okay, back to Roger Lancaster on Mexico. Starting this maybe a little bit backwards, but who supports the opposition? What type of people support, who are going to vote for the opposition in this election? Because that'll be a relatively small proportion of the population, given Morena's expected victory. Let's deal with that first, and then we'll get on to AMLO and Morena's base and then all the rest of it.
Yeah, there's been a series of protest demonstrations and parades in Mexico City and other cities that are calling themselves the Marea Rosa, the pink tide, oddly enough. So they dress in pink. And they're easy to photograph because there's a crowd of people and they're in paint, right? And they have essentially thrown their support to Xochitl. And who are they and what are they like? Okay, so they're kind of, they're educated technocratic people who are accustomed to being listened to, who are accustomed to being given a certain weight in politics. They don't feel that coming off of Morena at all. And they're somewhat disaffected. It's the progressive yuppie vote that can't bring itself to pull the lever for Morena, right?
Who are still the old pre-voters? Who are the old PAN voters? Like who are the people who are voting for these, for these parties, probably driven in largely by dislike of AMLO and all that he represents?
I think dislike of AMLO at this point is a driving factor. And AMLO has logically polarized Mexican politics in part around his personality. AMLO loves a good brawl. He loves to get into it with his opponents. He loves calling them out. He loves embarrassing them. This is highly effective governance as theater. The masses like it, frankly. That scene where AMLO flashed the news reporter's business phone number on the screen, right? I mean, that's like, okay, think about who is upset by that, right?
Right, yeah.
They're not going to vote for Morena, right? And so And in fact, I do point out that AMLO's approval ratings shot up 5 to 7 points in the polls after he did that.
Right, right.
It did not harm him. It did not harm him in public opinion, because most people looked at the shitty, you know, attack job that the journalist had participated in, and they looked at what she had said and what she had specifically, you know, about AMLO's children, and then like, well, you know, yeah, I would have posted her phone number too, is the response of ordinary people, I think, to something like that, right? But those of us who are well-educated and know enough to know better, and we've had our educational habitus instruct us on the ways of like not doing things, we would vote against AMLO, and we would turn out in those pink tied demonstrations to show our disapproval of the way things are going. So the pink tied people are saying, you know, democracy is in peril. This is a strong arm dictatorial government that's breaking with democratic norms. We have to vote against it. In part,
are they saying that AMLO is going to turn Mexico into Venezuela or Cuba? What's the preferred boogeyman of?
This is a tough one, because those of us who were there in 2006 remember very well that the campaign was AMLO was Hugo Chavez. Like, AMLO was literally Hugo Chavez. And there were campaign ads that were like hammering that. And like, there were illegal slush funds of money being driving these ads and so on, right? And there was a famous one that I think, Clinton's. I'm blocking his name. Clinton's campaign manager had come up with, right? Bill Clinton's. And it has a bicycle leaning against a wall, and it's wobbly. It's about to tip. It's like not quite stable, and it's going to fall over. The gist being that, like, you know, AMLO would destabilize Mexico and the bicycle would fall. So there's that vote. Right. And that I don't know how to call, like.
Yeah, but I think we get this.
Educated liberal voters are probably more of them are going to go for MC than for Xochitl, I suspect, when it all settles out. It's a strange thing. Traditional conservatives are certainly going to go for the PAN pre coalition candidate. And, you know, powerful supporters, you might say the ruling class, right? I mean, the elites are certainly unhappy with Morena in power, and they would mostly prefer not to have it, although a few of them have made their peace and have even come to something like constructive machinations with Morena. So, you know, it's a referendum on the past 6 years. If you feel like you benefited, if you feel like the guy did the best job he could do under the circumstances, if you feel like, you know, it's better than it was, if you feel like democracy opened up a bit, then you're going to vote for Shane Bauman.
Right. So I mean, well, I mean, like all,
and that's a big majority.
Yeah. Right. That's what I was going to get towards. That it seems that a lot of people are satisfied in some way with the way that the direction that Mexico has been heading in the past 6 years, and has a sense that at least AMLO had their back. So Shane Bauman is going to continue the coalition that he's built and the social basis of support that he has. That you said that it's polarized, and I think, as you have indicated, the tenor of the debate and the electoral campaign has been filled with lots of kind of hysterical claims, particularly from the opposition, about threat to democracy, authoritarian strongman, Caudillo, or whatever.
Crazy in the past 2 or 3 weeks. I think when the gravity of the numbers really sank in, the PRIAN campaign went weird and negative. Like there's this, it's got a weird vibe coming off it, but and it's negative and angry all at the same time. So if you look at the ads they're rolling out, it's like they're chastising the public for not voting for them. Literally, they're chastising the public now.
Which is never a good look. It's never a good look.
Bad note to end on. The public doesn't like to be chastised. So, yeah, it's got this weird, angry, negative energy. And I think it's probably hurting them a lot more than what they would have. If they had just stood still and not said anything, they would be better off than they've gone negative. They, you know, they try to remind you that Sheinbaum is Jewish. Now, I sometimes wonder whether there's, you know, an undercurrent. You know, in American politics, there are famous cases where it looked like the black candidate was winning, and then when the votes came in, it turned out he wasn't. And so is there a similar dynamic happening here where voters are embarrassed to tell you that they're not going to vote for Sheinbaum because she's Jewish? I don't think so. I don't think it works that way at all.
I would find it surprising, particularly Mexico, if there was kind of an undercurrent of anti-Semitism, which would kind of be skeptical of her as, you know, not Christian or something.
There's ordinary, mundane, garden variety anti-Semitism in Mexico. There really is. And it's a weird variety. It was imported from Spain. Like it came over on Spanish, you know, ships, and it frames a certain amount of cultural reflexes, but Sheinbaum has done her due diligence. You know, she went around, she campaigned hard in every village. She can't stick her head out the door without being mobbed by adoring members of the public, right? She's everywhere she goes, throngs turn out. Someone gave her a rosary at a campaign stop and she wore it for 3 days.
So I mean, wait. So before we get on to what AMLO's legacy has been and why it's been such a seeming resounding success that, you know, maybe something like 60% of people will vote for AMLO's chosen successor. You mentioned polarization. How clear is the class polarization behind? Well, you know, in as it plays out in this election.
So this is the interesting thing. All right. So AMLO came in on a vote in 2018 that was a massive rejection of the political status quo. And that's important to remember, right? I mean, so you had the Fox administration in 2000. Then you had the Calderon administration in 2006. Both of them were PAN. And then you switched back again to PRI with Peña Nieto and from 2012 to 2018, right? So you had these three consecutive experiments in democracy, as it were. They were extremely disappointing to most people. And by 2018, by the end of a very corrupt and troubling run, Mexican voters en masse voted against the status quo. Now, if you analyze closely the results, AMLO did well in middle class. Neighbor, you know, he did well with the middle classes. He did well with the working class. He did well with peasant villages and so on. There wasn't a strong class polarity to his. There was some, but it wasn't a strong class polarization yet. By the midterm elections, that has changed. Like, you know, AMLO has established his policies as a kind, I don't know, you know, populist economic policies, certainly rolling out more benefits for more people. So AMLO started a process of expanding existing benefits and creating new benefits at the same time. And a lot of people benefit, like poor people benefited from it, right? He also,
so, I mean, has he been able to build a kind of new constituency, a new basis on the basis of that welfare spending? I mean, I'm thinking a little bit of what Lula did in his first terms in Brazil, where he didn't have the support of the poor. He won that over in the course of being in power.
Interesting. And I think very similar, right? So by those midterm elections, it's very clear that there's class polarization happening. So like take Mexico City, for example. Mexico City is an interesting case. It is a leftist city, but it's not a city that's reflexively in favor of one party or another. They will give votes to PAN or PRI or Morena or what have you, right? So while Morena had won all of the neighborhoods in Mexico City by good margins in 2018, by the off-term elections, the city is split right down the middle. PAN won the nicer neighborhoods. PAN won, you know, the educated middle class voters. And Morena won in the half of the city where poor people live, working class people live, that aren't places where tourists go, and so on, right? So by that election, the class polarization was becoming very clear. Now, will that accelerate this year? We'll see. I suspect it will. You know, I do think that Sheinbaum will get a lot of NGO type educated activist votes that AMLO had lost back in that off year election, right? So I think she'll claw back some of those middle class votes that AMLO lost. But I also don't think that the middle class is as a whole, certainly, you know, maybe the commercial middle class or the non-activist segments and so on. I don't think they're on board. And I think you will. And I think she will run up the numbers. She will run the board in working class and low income rural areas. And she may very well, you know, up AMLO's margins there considerably. We'll see.
Right. I mean, one last thing just briefly on this. I mean, because some of the discussion has made reference to the fact that Mexico is bucking the kind of class inversion that is going on all across the West and beyond, the development of a so-called Brahmin left and so on, and that in Mexico this hasn't happened. In fact, that AMLO has alienated the kind of educated cultural left in academia and NGOs and stuff like that. Has that happened? What's been the basis of that?
Yeah, I think it has happened. And it's been, you know, look, I mean, so, all right, I'll give AMLO a good deal of praise here. But then I'm going to double back and say that maybe one of the things that Claudia wants to do is to bring down the level of the rhetoric a little bit, right? But I mean, the whole austerity thing that you alluded to earlier, it's important to understand what AMLO mean. AMLO doesn't mean austerity in the usual sense.
What is Republican austerity?
Maddening how he's used this word, right? I mean, austerity usually means that the working class and the poor are going to take it on the chin. And that's been the actual fact in Mexico since about 1982, right? The way AMLO has used the term Republican austerity, he's I'll also draw in an analogy that some of your listeners won't like. I mean, this is a left-wing version of drain the swamp.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, it's absolutely popular. It absolutely has support
among I doubt our listeners are so hysterical as to be horrorized by something like that.
Horrorized by a Trump analogy.
Yeah, like, no, I think they'll be fine with that.
Okay. All right. They'll be fine with it. Okay. So drain the swamp on the Republican austerity model means that, as AMLO puts it, there will be no more rich government and poor nation. And by rich government, like, you know, look, the civil servants and the government providing class had enriched itself very, they enjoyed perquisites and they enjoyed bonuses and they had high salaries and they also were taking money under the table and so on, right?
I mean, I guess like most developing countries and certainly across Latin America, that there's been a dependency on the state, right? Yeah. That capital doesn't stand on its own two feet very well. And, you know, the state, then the judiciary is fabulously paid and a lot of the civil servants are very well paid. And it's a route, you know, it's basically sinecure, right? For sections of the state sinecure. Middle class.
And people view their office as like property from which they can get a profit, and that's been part of how the governing class governed for many, many years, decades in Mexico, and also it's, you know, it like, so
attacking that must be popular, right? I mean, that must, if I let you kind of someone
popular to get that back, like, look, I mean, I remember talking to a friend of mine's father, like when AMLO was first elected, and he says, oh yeah, I lived in Mexico City when AMLO was governor there. You're going to see some changes. Like, before AMLO was governor of Mexico City, you would go to a government office to conduct business and you would wait all day. And you still wouldn't get your business done and you'd have to come back. And then you'd have to come back again. And then you'd have to change some money to move the paperwork along. When AMLO was governor, you went to a government office and goddammit, they attended to you when you came in. And you got your business done without passing a bribe. Like, that was a big change, right? Okay, so he's done this somewhat on a national level, right? So he has stripped the political class of its sinecures and perquisites. They have been very unhappy about that, by the way. And that's the source of a lot of the opposition to him. They have definitely felt this. That's his perpetual ongoing war with the Supreme Court, which was paid lavish salaries and had a slush fund. And so he seized their slush fund and redirected it to something else and so on, right? So there's been a constant battle over the surplus that's there located in government circuits. And AMLO has... Mm-hmm. has basically deprived the civil servant class from access to those circuits of surplus money floating around. This is extremely popular. I don't have to tell you, right? This is extremely popular. It's also
popular anybody anywhere in the world, I suspect. I mean,
it's also polarizing in quotation marks because it is, right? And he's, and again, look, a lot of what he does in his mañaneros, if you sit through them, and they are long and they happen every goddamn day, right? But if you sit through one of them, he is sort of constantly hectoring and haranguing the civil servants over their perquisites and privileges and so on, right? But on the other hand, there's also this other, I mean, and this would be useful to attend to more. I don't know, right? This involves deeper research than the sort that Centeno did in that piece in the New Left Review, right? But all right. So 2018, after the election, AMLO published a short book called Mexico's Mafia of Power, Mexico's Power Mafia. And he says in it right up front on the first page, as I recall, right? Something like, Mexico doesn't have a real capitalist class. Mexico has a class of crony capitalists who cut sweet deals with the state. And that's where their money comes from. And here, I'm going to name them for you now. And he goes down the list.
And I mean, it's interesting because this is really like of a piece with a lot of other left-wing populist experiments that happened in Southern Europe, for example, as well, where there was a real emphasis on anti-corruption from a left-wing anti-corruption politics, opposition to the caste or to the political class, and treating capitalism as a rigged thing was, you know, discourse which Bernie Sanders also used as well. You know, this is a rigged system. So it's not capitalism functioning as it should and having its natural tendencies towards inequality. No, it's rigged, that there is a political superstructure which is corrupting this thing.
As bad as raw capitalism would be, this is that with a whole bunch of corruption and like shady deals and subvention of government and so on built in, right? And so that's where like a lot of leftists looking at it abstractly from the outside are like, well, why isn't he building working class power on an autonomous basis, as though, you know, the working class isn't calling for that. That's the working class is not out calling for autonomous, you know, working class autonomism or something, right? That's not a real demand. It's maybe under different circumstances it would be. The demand was to deliver a blow against the entrenched crony system that had misgoverned Mexico for decades and decades. And on that count, the public has been generally pleased with the results, right? I mean, this would require more like, all right, so has AMLO disentangled the crony capitalists from their sources of government fund? Like maybe, maybe not. And maybe that is something to look at very closely. The perception is that he has, at least to some extent. And that's part of what drives his success. They don't automatically get what they want just because, you know, they have a political connection anymore. Melissa played along with this well, right? Like if you notice, I've been sort of surprised by it. Carlos Slim had been the richest man in the world. He's actually struck up a reasonable working relationship with Morena and AMLO and is like doesn't get in their way and sometimes cooperates on state enterprise ventures, puts forward some private money to support some public initiatives and so on. So, you know, a dynamic that no doubt would bear watching.
So I find it interesting because the populist anti-corruption politics, and I'm skeptical of that. I think it has a tendency towards a sort of moralization of politics. It doesn't raise people's consciousness in terms of how the system actually works. It has a risk of sowing illusions in a kind of pure capitalism. On the other hand, being able to break the new capital state nexuses that have emerged and been constructed over the neoliberal period would be a very good thing. And so indeed. I'm very interesting about whether I'm more okay with the practice of anti-corruption, at least, you know, or along the lines of what AMLO has spelled out of this sort of Republican austerity. I'm more interested in the practice of it than I am about the rhetoric, which I'm a little bit less keen on.
Well, corruption in Mexico was a real, I don't know what you call it, a nexus, a transfer point, a chokehold. In the circuits of public and private money, corruption was a very real way that elites helped themselves to public money for private interests. And yeah, it's interesting. You know, Carlos Slim was one of those people named in that book by Well, in 2018, maybe he's started to reform himself and like, okay, at any rate can see which way the wind was blowing and kind of starts.
And maybe is wealthy enough that he can see off the competition and doesn't need the state as much as
his competitors. He's wealthy enough that if, you know, he could give away $1 billion a year for the rest of his life and he'd still have like money to leave to, like a fortune to leave to his children, right? But yeah, I mean, it may be hard for listeners who don't come from a country where corruption is rampant to quite get their heads into what it feels like, you know. So in Mexico, the cops used to shake you down on the street for money. Right, it's happened. I drove a car through Mexico in 1984. I drove twice through into Mexico City and out of Mexico City. Both times I was pulled over, and the cop extracted a mordida, a bite from me.
Yeah, I mean, I would.
Again, in Morelia, I just kept driving. I didn't stop this time. But
I would maintain that this is the experience for the majority of humanity and the majority of countries in the world as well. Indeed, it's like it's the exception that certain countries don't have this experience. Of course, there's, you know, kind of corruption everywhere. But in terms of it being a kind of day-to-day experience and frustration that you deal with, that is maybe only in a minority of countries where that isn't the case.
The old regime was a regime of shakedowns, bribes, mordidas, extremely corrupt and also vertically organized. So, you know, I had a friend who you know, refused to give money to the cop that one time. And, you know, the cop was, you almost felt sorry for him. You don't really feel sorry for him, but like, he says, look, you know, you don't give me, like, think about it. You don't give me the money. I can't give the money to my boss. He can't give the money to his boss. And he can't pass it on up the system to the pre at the end. Like, what do you want? The whole system to fall apart? And of course, that's very much what this little communist agitator wanted, was for this whole system to fall apart, right? But you know, it was very durable and it lasted a long time. And everybody who ever had any, like, even if you didn't have any business with the state would go out and find you and shake you down, right? And this was, you know, the experience of being caught this way and humiliated this way without any recourse. I think you have to understand that to understand very well the salience of the anti-corruption politics in Mexico, for sure. But this is important that the public doesn't feel like it's being victimized this way.
Right. So I want to, you know, we've been going already for a good 45 minutes. I wanted to move on to talk about AMLO's legacy, or, you know, what his 6 years in power have been like. Because at the kind of top level macro indicators, as well as kind of more social concerns, it all seems to be not revolutionary, but rather good. Rather good in a context of recent Mexican history where there hasn't been a lot of that. Of some comparison, I'm just going to read some of them out. You know, the last year of their term, economic growth, the predecessor, Peña Nieto, left it, you know, it had growth of 2%, AMLO 3.4%. Industrial growth, much better than his predecessor. General, you know, industrial index, much better than his predecessor. Fixed investment higher, trade higher. The peso against the dollar is doing better. Primary results of Pemex, the state-owned oil company, better as well. So, you know, standard kind of macro capitalist indicators looking good, but also massive increase in the minimum wage. Monthly minimum wage was 2,650. Now it is 7,460. So, you know, more than doubled, more than tripled. So, you know, these are kind of serious advances, I think, probably that are felt in people's pockets.
This is a robustly successful performance on economic grounds, right? I mean, this is it, all right. It's not revolutionary exactly. I mean, AMLO came in on a campaign to break with neoliberalism, and he still says that he did, right? And Sheinbaum is saying something like, we're going to continue breaking with neoliberalism, which is sort of a suggestion that maybe it didn't completely end, but all right. But there is no master switch that you can pull that will make neoliberalism stop. It's far too ubiquitously integrated into everyday economic practices and even everyday life. But what he did do was he went in and he reset all the little switches on the board. He kind of started resetting those little switches in a way that begins to have some cumulative effects. And some of those numbers are very surprising. So I just thought the peso was going to continue getting weaker and weaker, right? I mean, it looked like it was for a very long time, but it's actually gone from about a 22 pesos per dollar back down to about 16 pesos. It goes between 16 and 17 now, right? Which is actually a strong indicator. I mean, far from spending money like a drunk sailor and, you know, running up huge deficits. The deficits in Mexico are very small compared to the deficits in the U.S., for example, right? I mean, we're talking, you know...
Well, the U.S. can get away with things that no other country can.
Europe and the U.S. have huge debts on the GDP. Mexico runs, I think it's at 2-3%. And it's only up that high in part because of COVID, right? But, you know, so he implemented reforms without raising taxes and without busting the budget. It's a precarious act. He pulled it off. Some of it he pulled off in part because of reshoring, which helps the economy a great deal. And reshoring is probably going to continue going on. So Mexico has a very bright economic future, unless something destabilizes there, right? But the U.S. isn't, when they reshore, they're not going to put those factories in the Midwest. They're going to put them in Mexico. Mexico will be the logical beneficiary of all of that. Productivity is up. It's not radically up. It could be up some more. If you want to look at something that you might, I mean, they're talking about like reducing the work week from 6 days to five to a 40-hour work week. Now, this is interesting. I've often felt like my friends in Mexico just work way too much, and they do. Okay. Better productivity would make that feasible, and maybe if you did it, you would get more productive. I don't know, but these are all going to be interesting.
I mean, I don't want to dwell on this, but I mean, I know that the informality rate hasn't changed greatly, and I think that's always such an important indicator, not talked about enough. And I will believe that, you know, there's serious change coming if that starts to change in reverse.
I agree. And that is something that AMLO was apparently trying to address. Like, he made it more difficult for industries and corporations to outsource key portions of their activities. So they were trying to undermine that access to the gray market in labor. As you can see from the figures, it hasn't been spectacularly successful yet. And, you know, it'll, absolutely.
Okay, so one final point in terms of what AMLO has done. Before we move on to, to finish off by talking about national identity, populism, and class. So one of the discussion points around how AMLO has ruled is his use of the military to kind of get things done when it's he doesn't want to use the private sector. So the military to build out airports or railways. And some have been critical of this because it's seen as militarizing public life. I haven't been able to necessarily make neither heads nor tails of it because could it be the domestication of the military as much as it's a militarization of public life? How has the military been represented? Is there a risk of a kind of, you know, sowing the seeds for future problems in terms of growing the military's role in public life?
When I got my COVID vaccine, I went to a military hospital to get it. I know this sounds shocking, like gringo anthropologist goes to a Mexican military hospital, but all right. I could go by the Social Security.
So that's where they implanted the microchip in you, right?
Yes, that makes me apologize. Okay, right? So look, there. I could go by the offices of the Social Security Institute that was also giving vaccines, and I could see that they were wrapped around two blocks of this, you know, lines of people standing in the hot sun waiting to get in. So I was rather shocked by my experience at the military hospital. Like there were no long lines outside. They hustled us in. They basically marched us in groups of 40. We went through various paces, and we first went here, then we went to a, you know, seating, all of it under a tent. We were never out in the sunlight, right? We were, as you might hope. And I think I was missing some paperwork because I was a foreigner. I didn't have something. And I said, this is where I see the incompetency of the bureaucracy. This is where I write my report about how it all broke down. But now they said, well, why don't you go over there to the Xerox machine and the photocopy office, and they'll take a copy of your passport and that will suffice. Oh. All right. So some young soldier marches me over, you know, I find the copy. And when I get there, I say, oh, I don't have much. I only have big bills. Like, oh, no, we're not going to charge you for this. This is just part of your vaccine. Go back. I eventually go to get my vaccine. Like they marched us in large groups of 20 or 40 into this big room with like a dozen 18 nurses all stationed around the room and they're like, shup, pop, pop, we all get the vaccine. You know, they not only do that, but they even show you, and this is your vaccine. You can see this is what it is. It's the AstraZeneca, blah, blah, blah. The expiration date is there. It's sealed, she says, twisting it to break it. Your needle here, it's also sealed. And we go through this whole, like, very efficient, very fast. And then they march us off to sit under another tent for 30 minutes and wait to see that we don't have a reaction. All right. All to say, if I were looking at institutions that could get things done in an orderly, efficient way in Mexico, the military would be one of those institutions that I would think of. Certainly more efficient at giving vaccines than the Social Security system was, right? So there, I think there's a good logic to that. I know I have friends in Mexico who would disagree with me. I know the Mexican military has done some very bad things. I get it. So part of what AMLO got off on a bad foot with the military early on in his presidency. The retired generals wrote a letter. This is a very severe warning. The military isn't allowed to write a letter. They won't do it. The retired generals, though, are allowed to do it. They speak for the military. And it was, you know, they wrote a very stern letter. After that, you could see All right, AMLO stops shooting off his mouth about the military so much, right? Because yeah, this was one of the institutions he would sometimes carp at, right? The actual incident was that he had intervened in some way when the military had captured one of the chapitos. And the narcos started shooting up the surrounding town. There was chaos. AMLO leaned in, said, let him go. Better to let him go than to have 100 civilian deaths. They let him go, but he also had some statements about it afterwards, and then the military reacted to that. All right. All to say AMLO was patching up relations with the military from fairly early on. I also would remind listeners that every public work in the United States that you can think of was probably built by the Army Corps of Engineers. We have a very long tradition in the US of using the military to build things, airports, dams, libraries. I mean, if you look at big public works in the US, if the WPA didn't build it, the Army Corps of Engineers did. And sometimes they were both involved. So I'm not, let's hope that these civilian projects will deter the military from its shadier pasts of narco trafficking and or abusing human rights and so on, and push it over into more socially productive activities. I can understand why some people might see it as a risk, but I'm not freaked out by it.
All right. We need to leave the military there. There's a whole other episode to be done on Mexico's military about narco traffic and cartels and the intermeshing and all the rest of that. That's a fascinating topic, but for another time. I wanted to talk about the discursive construction of the people that AMLO has undertaken, because I think a lot of the reasons for which he has a lot of fans and a lot of support, and why he seems to stand out as a successful left-wing politician in Latin America and even in a global context, is this idea that he's been able to channel a sort of populism, a construction of the people against the elite, and to rekindle class consciousness, which had somehow evaporated before. And do you think he's done that? Has he rekindled class consciousness? I mean, his own background is he's a child of provincial small shopkeepers, right? So I think he's been able to do this credibly. And I also wonder whether, you know, looking forward, whether Sheinbaum will be able to continue that and continue that like discursive project, given that she probably is less credible as a kind of populist leader.
Her communist and Trotskyist family background, though, makes one think that she knows how to frame this, right? I mean, so maybe she will, right? I mean, obviously she is herself an educated technocrat product of the education system and so on. But her uncle published a Trotskyist newspaper in the 1930s and 40s and 50s and somehow survived it all. And her father was a communist. So I don't think a Marxist class analysis would ever come as a shock to her. There was one of the end of the campaign videos was a woman from the class of 1968 saying how, she was there at Tlatelolco, she survived the massacre, and she's either in jail or visiting jail. I can't remember what it is. And there she saw a 7-year-old girl or a 6-year-old girl visiting political prisoners. And it was Claudia Sheinbaum when she was 6 years old, right? So at the end of the campaign, of course, Claudia is hitting all the notes and she's touching all the points. And this was one of the recurring ones, class of 68. But given her background and given her upbringing and given all of that, I suspect that she will be, maybe she'll be as good at it, or maybe she'll be better at it than AMLO in terms of framing things as class questions. We'll find out.
How significant, how real has this been? Because, you know, you can have these kind of discursive constructions which are used as a way of just shielding politicians from criticism and say, no, I really stand with the people, but in practice you're not doing that much. On the other hand, it can be, I mean, especially in a neoliberal context and all that has come before in terms of the neoliberalization of culture, the role maybe even that migration plays in Mexico, that people leaving, that if he has been able to refound the nation or refound some image of what it means to be Mexican, that would be quite significant. Now, I don't know if that's true. I'm putting this to you as a question, I suppose.
I don't know whether it's true or not. It's worth exploring. It's worth thinking about. You know, I have gut instincts about, look, the naming of the political movement, setting up all the words so that they spell out Morena is like the first step of along a certain populist class path. And remember that, like, you know that in Latin America, populism really, it doesn't just mean the people. It also means the popular classes. And the popular class is broadly understood, right? So Morena is a word that, dark-skinned woman. It describes a woman who is a mestiza and who is dark-skinned and who belongs to the popular classes. It's also a term sometimes you hear the Virgin of Guadalupe referred to as La Morena, because...
national icon effect.
You can only get Catholicism into the Aztec head in part by giving them this saint who was a dark-skinned woman, right? But there, right? So in the last year, there have been a lot of, well, in the last year, there's been a lot of polarization. And it seems to me that AMLO has played it well and to his advantage. So Fox, back when he was being extremely, you know, foolish, was tweeting and posting social media things about how terrible it was that AMLO was giving away things to poor people, that they would no longer have any incentive.
Fox being Vicente Fox, the Mexico's former oligarch president, right?
There you go. Yes. That people would no longer have an incentive to work. And of course, this is just classic conservatism in a way, but it was also, you know, AMLO picks it up as A, hatred of the people, which it is, B, a racist gesture, which in Mexico, it's a slippery term, right? But the 70% or so of people who are mestizo or dark skinned are being depicted as less worthy of things because of their so AMLO played these conflicts out very well. I think his popularity went up. Morena's popularity went up. Claudia Sheinbaum benefited from those polarizations, and she's continued playing them out. The discourse is there. The discourse is about the people meaning the popular classes, meaning the descendants of Mesoamerican civilization disproportionately, but not entirely, because look, AMLO himself isn't a descendant of his parents were Spanish immigrants. Claudia is like, you know, Bulgarian Jews who come over over the past two or three generations, right?
So it's a funny correlate with Dilma Rousseff, who took over from Lula, who's also not Jewish, but children of Bulgarians as well.
You frightened me with that analogy the last time.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
You did. You traumatized me with it because I don't like thinking about it. But so the discourse is there. The discourse is real. The Morena will play it up when pushed, and they'll play it down when it's not so much needed. Is it based on something? So have the popular classes improved, let's say, not only their livelihoods, but their standing and their sense of power? Have they or haven't they under all right? And again, it's all right. It's not been a revolutionary change. It's not, right? So let's put that aside. I think, though, that most people in the popular classes have seen their standard of living rise because they've seen their benefits increase. They have access to public goods in a way that they never had access before. AMLO's old age pensions are a big, it's not just the lives of old people that are being improved here. You know, it's their family members who are usually the primary caregivers for old, you know how it works in Latin America. You know, as AMLO reminds people from time to time, the family is the primary institution for social security in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it still is. We're going to help the family. We're not trying to hurt the family by offering money. We're trying to help the family, right? So that's a good approach. I think about that long line of older, like I stumbled into a pharmacy when the new prescription program was being rolled out, and I walk in and there's a long line of shabbily dressed poor, like some seem like peasants from the countryside, right? And it's older people and it's clearly poor people, and they're lined up at the pharmacy, and like the concierge or whatever it is at the pharmacy says, "What are you doing here? What do you want here?" I said, "Well, I came to get a prescription. I came to try to get something, but like, what's going on?" And he says, "This is the day that we're filling people's free prescriptions under the new program. You don't want to come here because it'll take there's a long line. They hadn't fine tuned the delivery system yet. I didn't see those lines afterwards, but like at the beginning, long queue to get the benefits. I went to another pharmacy. That was a kind of a concrete little visual image." Like, now imagine those older people going back to their families, going back to their homes, and their kids don't have to worry about getting them their diabetes medicine that month, right? And their kids don't have to worry about getting them their Lipitor or whatever they're taking, right? That comes as a real relief. There are other programs. It is shocking that I believe, if I'm not missing something, it passed the House and the Senate, the new retirement program. I'm sure AMLO has signed it into law by now. But everyone is covering all of the things I look at are covering the campaign, not government functions so much. But the new Social Security bill for pensions will provide, formal sector. We want to see more people in it, right? That will be a real gain. But the formal sector employees will retire with 100% of their last paycheck, up to, you know, there's got to be a cap, right? Up to, and it, the up to is not negligible, and it's about $1,000 a month, right? So whatever your work history was, right, you'll retire with your, and that's really good. That's a real tangible benefit, because most people were not getting that before. Most people were getting very meager retirements, even if they had done everything right, and even if they were in the formal system and so on. Meh.
So, I mean, this is all stuff which is very good kind of on the objective side, but maybe not so much on the subjective side. And so far as the working class as an agent, it seems not to, you know, I think that probably the most promising thing that I've read about is in terms of passing pro-union legislation or repealing anti-union legislation, because that at least, you know, takes the boot off the working class's back and allows it to organize for itself. So it seems like you have, on the one hand, these kind of welfare measures and other kind of elements of economic policy, which are popular or pro-poor or whatever. And you have a kind of discursive element, which is very much anti-elite, against the kind of educated class as well, not just the kind of ruling class. And it has kind of very much polarized things in that regard. But I guess the working class as a subject doesn't really come into the story too much here.
I don't think it does. Not. I mean, it comes in as references to the popular classes or the people, and it comes in as an under the rubric of a broader language. It's true. It's the labor law reforms are very important and will make it easy. I mean, it broke the back of the pre-labor unions, which is important because, you know, as long as the pre had a stranglehold over
right labor, and their control top down kind of, yeah,
it created union election procedures with responsibility involved, and it made it much easier to organize. Now, you know, that happened just before COVID. Then COVID happened, and under COVID, I still remember, you know, sometime in 2020. Walking with my husband, we're looking around, we're chatting, and then I'd say something like, you know, I'm really disappointed with AMLO. Like, I really feel a lot of disappointment with this administration, right? Yeah, it just feels like it could have been more, there could have been more. Of course, this was, you know, 2020, and like things were shitty everywhere. All right, that's over. We've moved on. Things are rolling again. Now new programs have been rolled out. Let's see if labor organizes more. Let's see if the working class congeals more as a coherent, independent voice. We'll find out. I don't think it's going to happen apart from Morena. Morena has put down sufficiently deep roots now that whatever happens won't be happening apart from it. This may disturb some listeners who expect, you know, independent working class to be genuinely independent, right? I don't suspect that will be the case, but who knows?
All right. Well, I mean, maybe just one last thing, just to finish off. What is there something to look forward to in terms of something on election day, which would be interesting for people to look out for, and or alternatively, something that you'd be kind of looking forward to? What another Morena term, the second floor of the of the construction that'll be being put together.
Well, one of the things that Sheinbaum has talked about is she's framed a lot of her discourses around rights to public goods. So the right to healthcare, the right to housing, the right to an education. She's actually, you know, things, a lot of what Morena is saying, a lot of what Morena did under AMLO, and some of what Sheinbaum says would come as no great surprise to anyone living in a social democracy in Europe or anyone who's ever been governed by a social democratic government, right? I mean, you know, but of, it is rather astonishing, though, to hear it talked about that way in Mexico, because even under the most populistic moment of the center-left dictatorship, it was not really done that way. So what to watch for? I don't know. I mean, I'm curious to see. I mean, I've guesstimated that she might get 57% of the vote. Does it go higher than that? It goes higher than that. Like, you have a lot of options that become available, right? I've put Galvez down at around 33%. If she goes down to 28, though, which is what she's running in some of the polls, the political establishment is going to be in panic mode with its hair on fire. There's probably no telling how bad that will sound, right? It already sounds bad. They're already talking about it, you know, the threat to democracy and on that slippery slope towards Chavezismo or something, right? So they're already performing these kinds of scripts for international audiences. But who knows? Maybe though they'll be so shocked by the results that they'll just pipe down for a while. you know, they might. I mean, my guess is they're facing a severe second reprimand, even more severe than the first reprimand. I'm still thinking about that independent working class power bit that you brought up, and I think that's very important. And I wish I had a better answer to it than I do. By 2018, the working class in Mexico had been completely destroyed. I mean, any semblance of class power had been smashed. You had had like real harsh neoliberalism in Mexico since 1982, and it just kept getting harsher. And anything that gave the popular class's power or standing or even basic dignity had been cut out from under them. And so by 2018, they were, you know, depoliticized, dispirited, and without much of a sense of cause. You know, to AMLO's undying credit, like, he tried to revivify a social movement based on the popular classes that would take power, and that in power, it's been prudent. Maybe it's been too prudent, right? Maybe it hasn't done enough, right? But your first 6 years shouldn't be the only 6 years you get. And like, nobody wanted to see a return to those periodic financial meltdowns that have afflicted Mexico since 82 and 94. And when some of those have happened in part because of very undisciplined and not very well thought out government spending programs. Nobody wants to go back to that, right? And in fact, that's part of what AMLO had to convince people that he wasn't going to do. That's why he said, I'm not going to raise taxes. That's why he dressed up his benefits for poor people and for working class people in terms of austerity, right? That's part. So part of his real challenge was to convince people that he was a safe option, given the history of having had a center-left dictatorship that was sometimes very reckless. There, and there we are, six mm-hmm. years later. We're surveying what happened over the past 6 years. We're hoping that the second administration will have the clout and the foresight to correct mistakes, build on successes, and keep moving forward.
All right, very good. Roger, thanks so much. This has been really informative, and I'm really looking forward to following Sunday's election. For listeners, we're going to be back with more on Mexico just after the election. We're going to have an episode with Juan Rojas, who's in Mexico now, and we're going to be kind of discussing more of these matters and trying to understand AMLO's legacy, whether he represents the future or...
I'm chatting about this with Juan. Excellent. So here, I'm going to make a call. This will be fun. Like, I'm going to call what will happen. All right? So here's my call. Sheinbaum, 57%. Galvez, 33%. Minus 10%. There, test me.
Very good. So there you have it, Lejeune. You know where to find Roger. You can find him on social media, whatever. Like, you're completely off. What are you talking about? All right.
I hope I'm off in a certain direction.
All right. Very good. Cheers, Roger.
Cheers. It's been a pleasure. This was fun.